Blog Talk Radio.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Troy Nunes is an Absolute Podcast. I'm your host, as always, John Casillo, and with me today is Dan Lyons.
Hello everyone, happy, everything that we know about Syracuse basketball's clock day today.
Yeah, Jesus. Had woken up hoping it was just going to be a day of talking about the tournament, and that's pretty much it. And then instead, morphed into, yeah, pretty much everybody sharing hot takes. I'm not even going to talk about those because I don't even want to. But obviously plenty of things that motivated the hot takes that we can discuss plenty.
Absolutely. And, yeah, if you see a link from Pat Forty, just don't click on it.
Yeah, I'd say if you see a link from Pat Forty, and to be honest, I think Pete DeMille too. Just kind of just tag it with an NSFW.
He's been like, I feel like at times he's worked really hard to like not have an alma mater bias, which is great. But especially the last couple of years, but man, that was just like people in the industry, like, bothering about stuff, because it seemed like he just unloaded, and it doesn't bother me with anything. And I said in our fabled internal news chat today that, like, it doesn't seem like anyone read this report. Like, bad things happen, but people are acting like Syracuse was this, like, den of just straight up, like, iniquity. Like, people acting like this is, like, the stuff that we read about in the Miami stuff thing. The Nevin Shapiro scandal. Like, I just don't get where the outrage is coming when this is not nearly the worst college scandal anyone's ever seen in the last even like 4 or 5 years. It's not even really close, in my opinion, in terms of like salaciousness. But people are freaking out. So I'm not convinced nearly like people who are paid to write about these things have in fact read like the full report and understand what actually happened.
No, I completely agree. And like we said, you know, it doesn't seem like everybody read it. And that's kind of disconcerting. I've always had an issue with people reporting opinions as fact. And I think that's the case here. It's just everyone kind of using a clickbait mentality to weigh in on conversations. Jared's here, so might as well welcome him into the powwow.
What a powwow we're going to have today, huh, gentlemen?
Yeah,
I mean, I thought it was mostly about UConn's walk to Arizona State, but I guess there are other things.
Yeah, I was saying on Twitter that the fact that UConn and Pitt already lost today is great. If we get ourselves a Georgetown upset, and that's the trifecta in terms of Syracuse fans not being as upset about not being in the tournament.
No, yeah, that would be very nice. It's always good to see. I guess we don't call them brothers. I guess enemies more than anything else, but go down in flames early on in March Madness. It's always a good thing when Georgetown loses early. Especially nowadays when the bracket comes out, and it's funny to listen to, like, national media experts when they break down their bracket, and everyone really gets to Georgetown, and they're like, oh, we can't pick Georgetown anymore because they're going to lose in the first round. So at least hopefully we got that to look forward to this weekend.
also, and this doesn't even come from like a place of like, hey, how in the world did Georgetown get a 14?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's when the bracket came out, that was one thing. Yeah, I mean, you have to compare them in Maryland, right? I mean, and the resumes there, and I don't know how that worked out. So, I don't know, maybe the committee felt bad or something for some reason. The Big East this year got pretty good seeds compared to everybody else.
For sure.
Yeah, I don't understand that.
Maybe you're 13 lost 15, like, crazy this year.
There's a lot of, I feel, Big East bias still, like, hanging around from when we were there and a lot of the other schools were there. Definitely a confusing time for the most part to see them given that much credit. I know we talked about it way earlier in the season, and I was kind of against against the Big East just for the sake of it. It was more of a, like, I don't understand why they're being given that much credit. And that's why I guess I'm kind of low on all those teams. I think I have at least three or four of them losing in the first round and the other two losing in the second round. It's just, it's not the same conference it was. It doesn't mean it's a bad conference, but to consider it in the same exact, you know, revered tones that it used to be, pretty difficult. And like we said, you know, like a 21-13 Xavier team getting through, Georgetown being pretty much just given name recognition as a four seed, definitely not the best. You know, I think if everyone wants to kind of go around, if there are other glaring issues with the bracket, I think that's a fine topic to go through before we dive into the actual picks and obviously some Syracuse stuff.
We're going to talk Syracuse today? I would have never thought of that. Looking at my bracket, I think I mentioned in the round table, my final four is pretty chalky-ish. I did have four number one seeds at one point, but then last night when I did my NCAA auction, for the first time I've done, by the way, that was my first annual auction, and that was a lot of fun, but I drew Iowa State. I didn't buy them, but I drew them as one of my random draws. So I've adopted Iowa State as my new team because I could win some pretty good coin if they get out there. So I had to pencil them into at least the championship game against Kentucky. But I do have a lot of early round upsets. But when it comes to seeding and stuff like that, I mean, it gets a little, you know, silly when the brackets come out and people are nitpicking to a 3 or a 4 or what's the, you know, difference between a 5 or a 6 or, like, who, why didn't we get an 11 seed and now we're at 12? Like, it just, to me, it makes no sense. You know, once you're in the tournament, unless you're in the playing games, as we like to call them, you really don't have an excuse. You just get in there, play. You have to beat the teams you have to beat. Some teams have easier roads than others, but eventually you're going to have to beat good teams to win the national championship. So it doesn't really, all in all, it doesn't really matter. And you know, eventually, as you move along, good teams get knocked out, and upsets continue. So it's always that's why it's always great, right? That's why we always like it. But when it came to the seedings and everything, yeah, the only one that really stood out to me was Georgetown one. It'll be fantastic to see them lose early on. So that's always good.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like I usually have a decent number of upsets and a pretty good rate in terms of picking them. This year, I can't get a good feeling for this tournament. So I'm a little lighter on the upsets than I like to be. I might go change a couple of those today or tonight right before, at least sometime before noon tomorrow. But I'm looking, hold on, I have to pull up the bracket here. The ones I do like, I think Wichita State, as we've discussed before, Indiana is probably one of the two or three most talented teams in the Midwest. I just have no trust at all in Tom Crean, and I think Wichita State just has that tournament pedigree where I could see them I think they're going to win that game. I actually also think they're going to beat Kansas, and I wouldn't be shocked if they beat a Notre Dame or a Butler or whoever else. I actually have Notre Dame advancing, which is probably to my my detriment, but I don't know. One of those years, like, it just seems like it lines up for them. I just think they're talented enough to get by Butler or Texas. So that's, you know, what I have in the Midwest. I like Wofford, and it's Arkansas. I could totally see Arkansas being really kind of down after the two performances they had in Kentucky in the end of the year. And Wofford's a pretty legit team. I like Ole Miss over Xavier because Xavier, like we said, incredibly overseeded. And then on the other side, I like Wyoming. UNI is obviously a really good team. They're actually one of the only teams that has like the magical stat of being in the top 25 in both offensive and defensive efficiency, which is, except for UConn last year, that's been one of the indicators of a national champion. Like every national champion up until UConn last year had been top 25 in both. They're only one of six teams, I think. But I like Wyoming a lot. I think they're a really good shooting team. So that's going to be an interesting one. I think if Dayton wins tonight, I think they can do a couple rounds. And then I like Eastern Washington, just because Georgetown always loses those games, and Eastern Washington scores the hell out of the ball. So, yes, a couple upsets, but and Davidson. I like Davidson, too. So, but I don't have a ton going very far. I think I have Dayton going a couple rounds. I'm debating taking Davidson over Gonzaga, but other than that, I'm more chalky than usual. I know you're not, John. Your bracket's kind of crazy.
Yeah, my bracket also results, too, from, and I said this on the noon Slack page, was just kind of, it's based on the fact that my money bracket is versus my boss, who's a Kentucky grad, as well as an office full of people who really don't care as much about college basketball. So for me, I kind of have to pick something other than chalk in order to win. We'll see what the final entry count comes in at, but it could be somewhere in the 20 to 30 range, which I think is just enough for me to, you know, I can't coast on some early. I mean, last season, not to brag, I went 30-2 in the first round, which, in no bracket format is that going to set you up for, like, at least guaranteed future success. It's just going to, you know, start you off well. I finished second, and my boss, again, Kentucky fan, won just because he didn't foresee anything. He foresaw, his team going far and it happened to work out. But, for me, I think the upsets are tough this year. Like you said, Dan, there's just a lot of matchups that just – All the big upsets you would normally see from really strong 12s or 11s are against really solid 5s and 6s. I used to Wyoming. I hope not, only because I had Northern Iowa going to the Final Four. I have UCI upsetting Louisville as one of my big ones in that first round. I've got Dayton, just like you, Dan, going a couple of rounds. Let's see what else we have in here. I got Eastern Washington, and not just because it's against Georgetown, but because Eastern Washington does have the ability to play a style that Georgetown simply can't keep up with. I mean, just like we saw 2 years ago, Florida Gulf Coast, they could do something very similar. Again, Georgetown should probably be the 6 in this region, maybe the 5, and I could see them losing to Stephen F. Austin or UCLA, but Eastern Washington should give them a lot. I got Davidson going a couple of rounds. I got Ohio State pulling an upset in the first round. I got Ole Miss going a couple of rounds. And then I got Texas winning against Butler, you know, another team that probably doesn't need to be where they are. But, yeah, I think overall my Final Four is pretty wild, just, again, because of the Kentucky factor. Had to go Maryland, Wisconsin, Northern Iowa, Iowa State. And if that works out – I don't know if I'm the only person in the country with that, but at the same time, I'm sure it's going to be a non-conventional pick. So that could get me the money, even if I get two of those teams right, as long as one of them is Maryland. But we'll see.
When it comes to big upsets, you guys are looking for the first round. I do have Georgia State over Baylor. And I had that for a while. But I was looking at Georgia State, and I was like, oh, that seems like maybe a possibly good upset for them. And then I looked, and then I realized they only scored 38 points when they won their conference tournament. So that really concerns me, but I just figured I'd take a flyer on Georgia State. And oddly enough, I had them winning, and I got them in my auction draft last night as a free pick'em. So that, you know, I have really interest there now too. So that's interesting. I do have Davidson going to the Sweet 16 and Stephen F. Austin going to the Sweet 16, Eastern Washington winning. So those are the upsets. But it seems that SF Austin and the Eastern Washington upsets are pretty popular right now. So I don't know how much of a trend that is there. When it comes to, I did like John, I did have UC Irvine beating Louisville. I don't see, one of my strategies that I usually have during filling out brackets, and I'm not saying I've won a lot of brackets, but I have a pretty strong contender in a lot of these. Usually at the end, it usually just depends on who wins the national title. One of my strategies I try to do when I fill out my bracket is if I, especially if you're like a higher seed, like a 2 or 3 or 4, and I don't think you're either good or I don't think you're going to make it past the first round, and I have like a pretty big upset like early on, I'll take you to like the Sweet 16, or I'll keep advancing you, or have that higher seed lose. That's one of the reasons why a couple years ago I actually had fought. I only fill out one bracket, just to let you know. I only do one bracket every year, and I submit it in all the other pools. And then, so that's the one. I did have a 40 Gulf Coast winning one year. They beat Georgetown, and that was one of the wide strategies I implemented. If I don't think the higher or the lower seed is good, I'm just going to advance, you know, the big upset. So I'm trying to think. A lot of people – I do have Butler going to the Sweet 16. That's really not an upset, but a lot of people do have Notre Dame advancing pretty far. Wichita State I have beating Kansas and going to the Elite Eight. That was a big toss-up for me to figure out who was going to go to the Elite Eight in that round there. But in Xavier, and it seems to be – I know they're the favorite, but they seem to be an underdog now because everybody's picking against them. I actually have them going to the Sweet 16, so – so that's pretty much my no huge, huge upsets going on to the Elite Eight or Final Four. Once you get to the Elite Eight, it's pretty much chalked for me, but I see those as being the upsets early on. So,
yeah, I am curious what has everyone. I mean, I get some of the reasoning behind Stephen F. Austin, but considering how just a few weeks ago, I think Utah was firmly in a 3 or 4 seed conversation, and they might have even gotten dropped a little too low at the 5. It's surprising there. I think a lot of people are getting a little too high on Buffalo. West Virginia was a really solid team, and Dan, I know that you were in the camp like I was of, you know, why is everyone so high on this team? I mean, not so high on this team, but, you know, why is it that West Virginia can't seem to put 2 straight solid performances together, but they were still playing well night in and night out. And I think, you know, that can't be discounted. I think a lot, there's people entertaining Valpo over Maryland pretty much, you know, entirely based on a Bryce Drew shot from over a decade ago. Yeah, just a lot of surprising things here. I mean, admittedly, at the same time, while I hate on, you know, basing things on historic performance, and I have MSU getting to the Elite Eight over in that part of the bracket, you know, simply because Tom Izzo has an ability to pull nonsensical upsets out of that.
I'll say real quickly on Utah. I know Vegas-wise, their odds are pretty good. I think they're like 1-33 to win the national championship, which is like, a lot higher than any 4 seed, I believe, and higher than a couple 3 seeds. So, yeah, they're a sneaky team. And I agree with John. That was one of the upsets I was really thinking about. But as I looked at my practice, I didn't have any 5-12 upsets, and I needed to find one. So I figured Stephen F. Austin was my best bet.
Yeah, I didn't almost Stephen F. Austin just because I think Utah's a much better team than they're probably underseeded. But I do think that SFA is a quite good team. I picked them for a couple rounds last year. It's just I just didn't like that one matchup. If they were against a couple of the other five, like if they were against Arkansas or West Virginia even, I might have taken them. I just didn't like that particular matchup. I have Utah going to the Sweet 16 and losing to Duke. And I don't even feel great about that. I think Utah is a pretty underseeded at five. I think they're a three or four seed level team.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that goes to, you know, kind of the question I alluded to earlier. Starting with you, Jared, like who's the team that was most underseeded? And that could be anyone across the board from a 1 through a 16. I guess who do you feel should have been maybe a couple spots higher?
Oh, man, that's tough for me. I didn't really look at the bracket like that. I'm trying to think, though. There was a couple that did stand out. Let me look here so I can remember. I don't have them off. I'm sorry, John. I don't have one off the top of my head. Usually when the brackets come out, I try not to really think about that. I just try to think about individual matchups, and I get lost in the end of the seeding in the sense. So I'm going to be useless in that standpoint. Probably Utah, right? I mean, Utah is the one that seems to be the one that everyone's kind of saying, well, they're much better than what they were perceived to get. And, yeah, I mean, I guess another one, too, is like UCLA. I mean, not that they were should have got, but a lot of people are debating whether they even should have been in the field. So, but when it comes to underseeding, I think, yeah, probably Utah takes the cake there.
I think they're definitely one of them. I think the most underseeded just that jumps off the page to me is Wichita State. And mostly, I don't think they're, you know, them being a 7 in and of itself isn't crazy, like if you compare it to other years. But when you have a Xavier at a 6, when you have teams like a bunch of other teams at the 5s and 6s, I just don't think they're significantly better. Even like Northern Iowa is really good, but Wichita really handled them in the last game, in the last game of the regular season. So the Shockers, I feel like, could have been a 5 or 6, and they're down at 7. That being said, I think they'd probably rather play Kansas than Maryland, so maybe it worked out for them.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I think, you can definitely see the biases inherent in the committee here. I mean, a huge, huge Big East bias, obviously. You see a big Big 12 bias. Obviously, that's how Texas got in. That's how Baylor was a 3. To me, I think you're right that Wichita State 7 seed is perplexing, especially up against, you know, a couple squads like Butler, like Providence. I mean, I'd probably take them. I'd take them over every 6 seed, without a doubt. And I know, like, day of, I definitely complained about the 1 seed, too. I know Streaking the Lawn, SB Nation's UVA site, did an interesting comparison about how many times the highest-seeded ACC team was not the regular season or tournament champion. It's only happened twice, 1994 and this year, and both times Duke was the highest-seeded, ended up being the highest-seeded team despite winning neither, which I found not coincidental. Based on some brand name recognition. I think a couple of years ago they were up against, well, in 94 they were up against Clemson and Georgia Tech for that. And then this year up against Virginia and Notre Dame. So again, a little bit of brand name favoritism going on, at least on paper. I do think it's perplexing how Virginia was left out of that 1 seed conversation. And to be honest, and again, I said that day, I think Virginia and Arizona would have made much more fitting 1 seeds than Duke and Villanova, but that could just be my own biases. And the fact that Villanova technically is the 2nd overall seed is a bit, and Duke is the 3rd overall seed, again, is puzzling.
Yeah, we've talked about Villanova a bunch. Like, their resume is good enough, but their resume is also based on all these other Big East teams being probably better than we believe they are. Virginia missing out just seems weird to me. I guess if you have doubts about Justin Anderson, maybe it's a little more legitimate, and we'll see. I mean, he didn't play very much in the ACC tournament. He definitely didn't look 100%. So if he's out, then they probably aren't a one seed. But based on what they did this season, that's one of the two or three best teams in the country. So it's a tough position, but luckily the East, I think, is the weakest region I can remember in a long time. I have Virginia coming out of it, only because I have the fewest questions about them compared to the other, like, top seeds. So if they do get Anderson 100%, if their other guys stay healthy, get good performances from Brogdon and a few of the others, I mean, they still can very easily take that region. It's not like they got stuck with Kentucky. So it kind of sucks for them that they're not a one, but I think if you're going to be a two, that's probably the most advantageous position to be a two in.
Yeah, I agree there. I think that you're dead on. I mean, again, it's kind of a gamble on Anderson's health at the end of the day. And I guess that's why, at the same time, like that's not why UVA was dropped from a one. Because I know when they interviewed, the committee chair after the selections, they said that no matter what happened in the Big Ten title game, Wisconsin had already solidified their place as a one. And while I agree with that, and I do think they had solidified themselves as a one, the fact that they were slotted in as the fourth one says to me that it didn't matter what UVA did. And that's surprising to me, I guess. I'm someone picking UVA to get upset within a couple of rounds, but that's really just because of Anderson's health and the fact that they had the misfortune of going up against Michigan State. But I do find it very odd that the committee seemed pretty set going into the Sunday games, that these were the four when it's not that Duke and Villanova are not accomplished, but I just think that there might have been a couple more accomplished teams on those two lines.
Yeah, for sure.
I'd had nothing to add.
Well, thank you, Jared. Anyway, I guess before we jump, maybe we go back a little Syracuse stuff. Let's chat some beer. It's a slightly early halftime.
I'm pulling out my Untappd right now.
I will just say that the other day I had Rolling Rock Ponies for the first time in a long time, so that was nice.
Just before I get into like the decent stuff I drank, I was in Columbia, South Carolina, visiting friends for their ridiculous St. Patrick's Day celebration, and I had probably more Guinness on Saturday than I've had in the rest of my life combined. And that's not to say I think Guinness is fine, and I like Guinness. It's just not something I usually drink. But, yeah, I had a lot of it on Saturday for a good, 11 hours. So, that was
nice. My stomach is turning just thinking about that.
Yeah, it was a long day. I did have some other stuff. There was a really good gastropub near where my friend lives. I had the Grapefruit Sculpin from Ballast Point Brewing. Really good, the grapefruit flavor, pretty understated. Like, you know it's there, but it's not defining the beer. Really nice flavor, really drinkable. Enjoyed that. I believe that's California, right, John, at Ballast Point?
Yeah, that's down in San Diego.
I had Craver Peanut Butter Porter. I very rarely drink porters. This one was really interesting. Definite peanut butter flavor there, but it didn't feel like you were like drinking a peanut butter, smoothie or anything. It was just kind of like at the out front of the flavor, but it didn't linger too much. So decent. I'm not a huge porter guy, but pretty solid. And I like what the peanut butter brought to it without totally, dominating the flavor there. Let's see what else. I had Jade IPA from Foothills, really solid, IPA, nothing nothing too crazy, but, you know, nice drink. I like most of what Buffalo Hills puts out. And then a couple other more basic things, 312 Urban Wheat from Goose Island, which I drink pretty regularly, and then a Fat Tire from New Belgium, which I don't always get to have. It's a solid beer. I think some people, like, really talk it up, but I'm not so crazy about it, but I do enjoy it when I've had the chance to have it.
Very nice. For me, things I had recently via trade, got to try out Surly's Brace of Ale, double IPA. Excellent, excellent beer if you're into double IPAs. Felt like it towed the line very nicely between East Coast and West Coast styles. Not too malty or too hoppy on either end. Also got to enjoy a Westbrook IPA down in South Carolina. And I felt like that one, you know, was fairly similar. I felt like it managed to have a really nice hop character without being too heavy at all. And also had, like, Arizona doesn't have a great beer scene by any means, but was out in Phoenix and got to try out a couple different things. Fate Brewing has their SPA, their single pale ale. It was one of my favorites when I was out there. Also had a very interesting one from Fate, the Chardonnay Barrel Aged Droppin' Beet Saison. It was a kind of a beet flavored saison that I was skeptical of at first, but it actually was one of the more interesting beers it had. Enjoyed that, as well as the Odell Bruins Runoff Red IPA. And beyond that, not a ton of other things. Like I said, Arizona doesn't have, like, a huge beer scene. Try to, like, just get a feel for all of it. So had a Cardinal Pale Ale from Nebraska Brewing Company. And that's the long and short of it. Definitely some good stuff. Was really glad to see Arizona gets a Founders distribution. So that was nice. So I got to pick myself up a four-pack of Founders Breakfast Stout over at BevMo there. And California, at least not yet, doesn't get Founders. But they're going to soon. Problem is that the demand on that's going to be too big for anyone to get some in a reasonable amount of time.
I'm shocked they haven't made it to California yet. I mean, I feel like everywhere it has Founders now, so it's kind of crazy that it hasn't hit California yet. But
it seems like they are. It seems like there's been some hints that they're definitely going to be out here soon. The issue is, for a lot of brewers that aren't in California already, if your standard brews are IPAs, you're going to have a very hard time getting into any of the markets out here just because of how well we do IPAs and the preference toward them, the preference to drink local. You know, there's plenty of, like, just big brewers that just don't bother with it. I think for Founders, and the same with Bell's, I think from what I've seen, Bell's IPAs are kind of hanging around on shelves, not really moving. While their stouts and porters and everything are really flying off the shelves, I think the same thing's going to happen for Founders. We don't really have much of a porter or stout culture out here. And we also have a limited amount of places that do sours really well. So breweries that are going to excel, you know, with those styles are probably going to do best out here, in my opinion. But yeah, go for it, Dan.
No, it's nothing to do with beer. I forgot what I was going to say, and then I realized this is going to shock you guys, but Dayton just banked in a three-pointer.
Of course. Of course. Funny Twitter message that I just saw from Trey Noon's own Michael Burke. Realization, with the vacated win, Syracuse did not, in fact, win 10 fucking games in 2005-2006. I found highly entertaining.
I can't wait to also find out in, like, the next 3 days that the long-fabled assistant coach actually did get a head coaching job.
Oh, man.
Yeah, that'd be awful, wouldn't it?
Everything we thought we knew about Syracuse basketball is just coming to an end.
coming to an end in a couple days, man, though. you know, it's been 4 or 5 years now since everything's been completely crazy. So, but no, yeah, what an interesting day today, huh, guys? I mean, basically what I was doing today is getting ready to do some other real work stuff, and then all the news broke, and it was off to the races. And it was interesting because I think you both of you guys know I've been trying to work up my Daryl Gross hot takes column for a while, and I kind of let it sit for a while because I was waiting for to see what Syracuse University was going to do, and sort of decided that if they didn't respond before the NCAA tournament, like by Friday or you know whatever it is, because I figured they wouldn't release anything during the week, that I'd by Monday come around to get ready it. And luckily they did the job for me. And I can say personally, I think 12 days isn't bad. I would have liked it a little sooner on the Gross thing. But, you know, it is what it is. I mean, they give them time to breathe a little bit, come up with some options and how everything's going to play out. And the chancellor did his job. And so that was interesting to get a take. And then, of course, everything pretty much boiled over for me temper-wise and anger-wise when Gross went on his PR campaign this afternoon, first with Syracuse.com, basically saying that his change was his idea, his and the chancellor's idea, and that, you know, he's looking forward to this new opportunity and yada, yada, BS, BS. And it just infuriated me because that's the one thing I just don't think Gross ever got when he was in his job, is he was in the, you know, car salesman business when it comes to Syracuse University. And don't get me wrong, he was a fantastic car salesman, but everyone knew, like, you know, if you did your homework on, you know, selling cars or, you know, what's a great deal on a car is, he was complete, you know, he was just a bullshitter the whole time. And he came off pretty fake. And that's what today, him trying to is make everything, you know, all sunshine, really upset me and tweaked me. And that's why I kind of wrote what I wrote today. And I actually called Brent X. I hopped on his show briefly to kind of, you know, just let everybody know that, you know, we here at Noons, Troy Noons, aren't buying his BS. And, you know, everyone has to kind of make sure he's held responsible for his actions in this whole NCAA ordeal.
Yeah, I mean, him trying to sell that he wasn't like demoted or whatever by someone else, like, obviously kind of ridiculous. I'm not surprised that he said it because I've, you know, been a Syracuse fan for more than a day. But it was pretty funny seeing him try to spin that into a, you know, everything's hunky-dory and, you know, no one did anything wrong and et cetera, but it can't be too surprised.
I mean, his freaking name is in the report, like, how many times? I mean, there are literally two instances in the NCAA report. I know he's saying that it's different. The way it went down is different from what it's in the report, but I don't believe that for a second. But he can defend it. He's got a right to defend himself. But in two huge instances in those reports, one, he was, you know, the leader of the pack in trying to figure out how to change Shadnell's grades in the correct way. Like, how are we going to do this? And the other way was just blatant disregard for the drug policy. And we can get into, like, whether or not, you know, Syracuse should have or shouldn't have a drug policy. They shouldn't have because there's no point in it other than to get yourself in trouble. But he just completely ignored that part of it and literally told Behan to ignore it. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, the NCAA came down as hard as they did. A lot of it is just because of that lack of, they say, institutional control in the fact that it blatantly disregarded some of these NCAA rules. And that's what ticked a lot of people off, and it's continuing to tick a lot of people off in the national media because of this, just like, well, you know, whatever. You know, everyone's doing it, or, you know, you know, that's really not how it went down, or, you know, it's not that big of a deal. Well, you know what? In the end, it's a big deal. It is a big deal. 3 years of scholarships are gone. Many vacated wins are gone. You know, money from, you know, conferences and TV deals are in bowl money are gone. It's just crazy, and it's just inexcusable for a quote-unquote leader just to come out like that and just try to see if he can trick everyone into believing his bullshit, which is completely what he tried to do today.
Yeah, I think it's pretty very, very accurate depiction. I think it was just one last round of spin. You know, I don't necessarily buy it. I doubt most buy it at all, to be honest. And it's just, again, it was a pretty weird day to be a Syracuse fan, given, you know, kind of the reactions around Boeheim. And I guess we're going to get a lot more from Jim tomorrow, and we'll really see what happens with Hopkins tomorrow. But I think it was just weird to see Gross kind of acting as a free agent. I mean, we knew he was going to be gone. That didn't change the fact that once it happened, we were intrigued and surprised. But then to see him kind of act as if he was not really involved with the university anymore and pretty much protecting the most important brand of all, you know, Dr. Darryl Gross, was definitely an odd one for me anyway.
Yeah, I mean, it's a weird day, mostly because I don't think we expect, I mean, no one expected such a definite timetable to be out there for Boeheim's retirement. But if you had told anyone, like say the day that Stivers took over, we had a new chancellor, we'd moved on from the Cantor administration. If you told everyone that with no thought to the NCAA investigation, just like as a general thing that Stivrud would want a new athletic director for his first full year as chancellor, and Gross would move on, or, you know, the whole whatever role he's taking on, I don't really buy it. He'll be gone sooner than later. And that Boeheim would retire after the 2018 season, I don't think anyone would have been particularly surprised with either of those things. So obviously, they've been spurred on and attached to the NCAA, all the NCAA stuff. But it's just like it was surprising to see the Boeheim thing put out there so much so far ahead of time and connected to something like this. But I don't think the actual time frame. Like some people were freaking out today about Boeheim leaving. I'm like, did you expect him to coach till he was 80? Because I didn't think he was, and if you had told me, you know, that he was only going to do 3 more years, I'd say, yeah, that's a pretty reasonable amount for where he is in his career. So I don't think today was quite as groundbreaking as it was just a little surprising because of the delivery. But the actual news doesn't surprise me when you think about it for a bit.
Right. I mean, I think the lack, like, there were so many people I saw, and again, this, without going too far into the hot takes and everything, to see the reactions today about Gross and Boeheim, and thinking that these two things weren't coming is confusing and really just kind of silly to me. Like, if you don't have to follow Syracuse sports at the level that we do to understand that these were coming. There's been numerous articles written that they were coming. And then to see, again, the shock and surprise and everything, like this all just happened today, just doesn't really make much sense to me anyway.
I'm surprised they didn't do it tomorrow. Let's do the actual announcement tomorrow, like right at 10 a.m., like they're going to have the Boeheim press conference, and then just let it totally get buried by 4 days of nonstop basketball.
Yeah, we did talk about that, too, in the Slack chat room, in the sense that, like, why today? Obviously, it's like PR 101, as John will tell you. It's like, release it today, then it's forgotten tomorrow. But I also had the opinion today that I think, you know, Syracuse did think that if they released it today, it would get covered today, and at least it would be put out there that they did something, you know, because everyone's been, you know, with their pitchforks and knives and or whatever when it comes to Boeheim's head and our Dale Gross's head. And, you know, finally they did something. So at least people took notice in that one, especially the college basketball world, and that will be a topic of discussion for today, and then maybe a little bit in the morning, but then after that, it's going to get buried until they find a new athletic director. So,
I also thought it was hilarious today, kind of along the same lines of, like, it doesn't seem like everyone read the report and correctly digested how, you know, not that ridiculous the stuff that Syracuse did was when compared to a lot of other schools that have been found in violation of the NCAA code. But it was really funny today to see all the, oh, my God, how is Syracuse going to recruit now people, which was, like, Mike Hopkins was named coach in waiting like a decade ago, and every time anyone's been asked about it, aside from the few instances of Hopkins maybe leaving, which he hasn't, nothing's changed in that regard. And Hopkins is the lead recruiter for Syracuse. Boeheim kind of comes in to close the deal, but Hopkins is the one that builds the relationship with all the players. We've heard that Hopkins, you know, the players that commit to Syracuse who expect to stay 4 years, all understand the possibility that Hopkins will be their head coach at some point because Boeheim is 70 years old. So while this puts, like, a more definitive time frame on things, and maybe it'll, you know, a recruit who would have been a one-and-done doesn't want to come anymore because he wanted to play 1 year for Boeheim, I don't think that most players, and just by looking at the responses from Matthew Moyer and Tyus Battle, our 2016 commit and our 2016, I wouldn't say lean, but possible lean if we have a space for him. Like, they seem totally not worried about anything, and they'll both probably be on the team when Hopkins takes over. So it was just funny to see, like, everyone searching for this, like, further way to tear down Syracuse basketball when it's pretty much a total non-issue in terms of recruiting and in terms of the transition. It's going to go the same as it would have, and whether or not Hopkins works out, that's a whole different story. But there's no real unless, like, some crazy big job opens up in the next 2 years, I really now don't see Hopkins leaving when he knows exactly when the time is going to come for him to take over.
Yeah, it was interesting. I was listening to CBS podcast today with Gary Parrish and Matt Norlander and those guys, and they usually have pretty decent takes on these situations. I mean, Parrish can, you know, he's a columnist, so once in a while he has pretty strong opinions, but, you know, I think he's pretty – out of all the columnists out there, I think he, college basketball columnists out there, I think he's the most fair one. But it was interesting when they were talking about, you know, Syracuse's quote-unquote possible coaching search if Hopkins doesn't work out. And they were trying to put Syracuse, like, on what tier they are. And, you know, depending on how the sanctions go out and how the scholarship situation is, Syracuse could be a good job for a coach, you know, moving up the ranks in 3 years, or you could say maybe 5 years, maybe to give Hopkins a couple of years to see if he can do good in his job. Or, you know, it's going to be a job, a really bad job to take over. So that's another thing, too, like, in the sense of Hopkins is maybe Syracuse won't have that choice in 3 years, you know. They'll have to go with Hopkins because he'll be the only good option on the table. So it will be interesting, but I think, like Dan said, I think Hopkins is all right. He's going to be just fine, at least in my opinion.
Yeah, you know, I think the issue is, too, that some people who are jumping to conclusions, and admittedly, I think we jumped to some conclusions ourselves, you know, when Jim Calhoun left UConn and then UConn didn't get into a power conference. And granted, I think most of the players they won with last year were, you know, Big East recruited players when UConn was still relevant. And I've even seen some UConn fans weighing in today after the NIT loss, thinking, you know, like, this feels different, that this is disconcerting. And I wouldn't blame them for being concerned. But Syracuse is in a very different place. For better or for worse, Syracuse is a top 10 brand in college basketball. Yes, I just used the word brand. You know,
take a drink.
But SU is, you know, well situated. They're in the ACC. They just have a lot more going for them than not UConn. I'm not going to make that comparison. But they have much more going for them than most schools would in this situation. Obviously, it's a difficult conference. Obviously, it won't be easy. But whether Hopkins is there or not, and again, we set up this succession plan just for this situation. Syracuse, again, is well set to be relevant, to be successful, as long as the current, you know, collegiate structure stays. And that's the benefit of being in a Power 5 conference. And that's the benefit, really, of Gross's tenure, is getting us there. And as much as we want to pan him and should pan him for what happened in this report, he definitely did us a solid getting us to where we are.
Yeah,
totally agree.
That's a great point. On both accounts, you know, say Hopkins takes say UCLA opens up and Hopkins takes it, and that's, you know, probably not going to happen, but pure hypothetical. And Boeheim obviously keeps with his 3-year time frame, which he did say, like, he didn't say he like definitively that it was going to happen. He just seemed to, that was his plan. But say he sticks with that, you know, the Cherry Dome isn't going anywhere as far as we know. At the very least, the 30,000 fans for any kind of a big game aren't going anywhere. And the Carmelo Anthony Center, which is one of the best facilities in the country, if not the best, is not going anywhere. So Syracuse is in a pretty good position. Hopkins or no Hopkins, Boeheim, no Boeheim. I think when you have a coach who's been here for near 40 years now and has built a program that's a power at the level of Syracuse, like, it's not all going to fall apart right away. Obviously, if they were to hire a really bad coach, or if Hopkins was to totally bomb, then there's a worry. But Syracuse is in about as good of a position as it can be to replace a guy like Boeheim.
Yeah, and I did an interview, a radio interview earlier today after everything kind of went down, and somebody asked me about, you know, what, you know, with the Boeheim news, you know, and all the penalties that are going on, you know, what's my thoughts on the program moving forward? And, you know, I think I said this in the last podcast, but I still kind of strongly believe this, in the sense that Syracuse can really easily survive this if things go pretty well. Like, you know, because the recruiting class next year is good. It could be, you know, just as good the following year, you know, depending on if they get, you know, another one-and-done player to kind of plug in. And they should have guys – I mean, they have sophomores and freshmen now that should be on the team for another 2 or 3 years, which will also help. So, I mean, it just depends on how everything goes, you know, barring, you know, injuries or who decides to go to the NBA or transfer or whatever. But, you know, for what Boeheim has done with Hopkins and, like you said, Darryl Gross and branding the program to, you know, the elite level it is now, they should be okay moving forward. And but it is weird living in a world where, you know, Jim Boeheim has a timetable on his career. So, and we've never had that before.
Very much agree. I know we're getting toward the end here, and I figured we'll call back to something that was up today that I know I put together with some help from Kevin Wall up on the site, and that is, you know, who is our next athletic director? So I know both of you got a chance to glance over some choices, and these aren't the only choices, but I guess, Dan, starting with you, who out of those names in particular really kind of, you know, shout to you as an option we should go after? And then if there's anybody you don't see on that list, who might those people be?
I'm just reopening the first snap because I don't remember names specifically. I don't know. I'm of two minds with this search. It's really tough because when you have a coaching search like we have for football a couple times, it's a lot easier to go identify coaches out there who fit what you want and what profile you want from your next head coach than it is for ADs, just because the up-and-coming, like, associate athletic directors and people on the lower levels are far, you know, less known in terms of who they are. Like, you can go look up a bunch of people, but once you kind of look for connections like you did in this piece, it's hard to just go point out random people. I like, I think we all talked about Carla Williams from Georgia. She and Julie Venata from Ohio State and a couple of the other ones, they don't have the – they don't fit, like, the Syracuse profile in terms of, like, area, and they're both from big public schools. But that might not – like you say, that might not be the worst thing. They come from tremendous football backgrounds in terms but they all have various backgrounds in terms of academic support, and a couple of them have worked with compliance. All things I could see Chancellor Siverud really looking toward, considering what's happened over the last couple of years, and I think that would be a very good decision. I'd be interested. I keep on looking back to Siverud's time at Vanderbilt, just because that's a program. Well, Vanderbilt's athletic department very uniquely structured in terms of it's not really its own thing. I think everyone kind of has other roles with the university. Probably to keep the academic integrity of the university, you know, at the forefront. I do think.
Yeah, didn't they disband their athletic department?
Something like that. They don't have like a standalone athletic department in the sense that like every other school does, to my knowledge. I could be wrong.
I think they disbanded the athletic department around like 2005, and I was, as we were talking about it on Slack earlier, I was thinking about that, and it suddenly popped in my mind now. Yeah, I think it's not as if they got rid of athletics, obviously, but I think that, yeah, their formal athletic department is really, like, exactly how you were describing. It's a group of people who were kind of brought together from other parts of the university.
Yeah, and while Syracuse isn't going to do anything like that, having people from that kind of school that, you know, has private school, academically rigorous, which Syracuse is hopefully going to try to get back to a bit, and then kind of understand the things that are put on a school like that, and the fact that Siverud probably knows people from his time at Vandy, I think that's the most obvious background from his perspective that I think might come in handy. But he also has a lot of connections to people at Ohio State through forget his advisor's name, Jeff Kaplan. So it's hard for me to pinpoint someone specifically. I do hope it's someone who has a football background. I hope they are good with academics and compliance, because I don't want to see Siri getting in more trouble right away. But, yeah, if someone who's played at a football school like Ohio State or Georgia, or even a Vanderbilt who – in recent years has brought itself up out of nowhere, made a great hire with James Franklin, and competed, not at the top, but with a competitive team in the SEC, that wouldn't be a bad thing to bring to Syracuse, where I think winning is far more attainable in football than Vanderbilt is in the SEC.
Yeah, and as far as my opinion, I mean, when it comes to names, John, you'd be the best one to kind of go through all this stuff. I mean, I read your piece, and it's a great piece, by the way. If you're listening to the podcast and kind of want to know what direction Syracuse could go, John, you and I think it was Ken work. Who else worked with you? Did Ken work with you today? Or Kevin?
Kevin and I kind of pieced these together based on searches.
Yeah, it was great job doing that. So, but yeah, as Dan said, in the sense that if you're just trying to target someone. Obviously, the academic background is going to be looked at pretty well after what just happened. But also, you want someone who is smart in the sense of like just running to making sure everyone's complying in what they're doing, and also also willing to go out there and get the money that needs to be gotten, as we could say. But no, yeah, John, you'd be probably better. Off the, rattle off some good names since you did all the article work.
Sure. I've been talking to some people on Twitter about this, and the name that keeps coming up over and over again is, and it was kind of initiated by some fans that trace back to his time with Big East in Syracuse, and then Bruce Feldman tweet is Nick Carparelli. I'm Under Armour exec now, but for the most part, he does have an athletics administration pedigree. Sean raised some red flags that, maybe we try to go away from the business and marketing side of things and try to go academic. And I would agree. The SU pedigree helps, especially because it's from the Pasqualoni era. It's from before Gross took over. I think that definitely helps him in a very big regard. But I don't necessarily know if he's the top choice. Some of the other folks, you know, I divide up the article into two different places, rising athletics administrators and sitting ADs. And the rising athletic administrators, I think, are the ones that really intrigue me, just because there's some really unconventional choices. Chris Kennedy from Duke, senior deputy director of athletics. He's got some Georgetown ties. Obviously, we're pretty friendly with Duke. I'm sure Coach K would provide a great recommendation. Overall, like, this is one that I could see, but I'm not as excited about it as I am some of the other ones. I think Carla Williams, from everything we talked about on Slack, is kind of the clubhouse favorite, at least for now. She doesn't seem like the you know, bold choice based on just resume to resume, but at the same time, very much has an SEC and football background. She has Vanderbilt ties, which, you know, goes back to what Dan was saying earlier. The fact that she has had so much responsibility on academic and compliance is great, and I think is going to be a huge step forward. Plus, you know what, at the end of the day, I think Chancellor Seabrood is a smart guy. I think he's someone who looks to embrace a more progressive way of thinking, and I think someone like, you know, a female like Carla would actually be very much in line with his way of thinking. Same goes for some of the other candidates we had on here. You know, Michelle Willis over at Ohio State, the Ohio State ties that we mentioned from Jeff Kaplan. And then Julie Venata, who is probably the most out of left field person, but, you know, somebody who has worked with the NCAA for general counsel and advisory, has a legal background just like Seabrood does. She's definitely done a lot with academics, with women's athletics. She overall does seem to fit a very interesting bill. I don't know if she's, you know, looking to move up or is ready to make that jump. She seems like she's a lifetime Ohio resident. So I think those are some names to keep in mind in terms of off-the-radar folks. I know not a ton of major schools are looking for new ADs right now, at least from what I saw. I know there was a one opening today that was filled. Colorado State hired was it Joe Parker from Texas Tech, who's their like senior deputy director. And then we also have just a couple, like, some rising names. I mean, these are all mercenaries for the most part, like Tom McClellan and Brian Wickstrom from Louisiana Tech and UL Monroe, respectively. They're just guys who seem like, you know, they're going to be moving up the rank. And if we want to be one of those stops, that might behoove us, but it could also set us back. Scott Barnes is in there. And then Kevin Anderson and Ward Manuel are names that just are going to come up, so I added them. But the real name here is going to be John Hart. He's currently the athletics director over at Bucknell. And by most accounts, you know, he was the finalist alongside Gross. The last time there was an athletic director search at Syracuse. So to me, Hart seems like, because of the academic and fundraising success at Bucknell, the fact that Bucknell is a much harder sell in terms of alumni fundraising for sports than Syracuse is, and still Hart was able to do a lot there and has been able to do a lot there for a decade. I think that speaks volumes about his abilities. I think, again, the academic stuff is huge, and his Syracuse tie is even better. But we'll see. I don't necessarily think that seals the deal for him. It's just, you know, so interesting stuff and names to think about. I'm sure there'll be a lot more added to the pile as the weeks kind of wear on in this search.
Yeah, Hart's definitely an interesting name. I was actually just reading the comments, and someone brought up that he was the finalist for the Gross search. It would definitely seems to be like he would definitely be, maybe not the anti-Gross, but like just moving back in kind of a different direction to kind of stabilize things, get the athletic director, the AD job kind of in order. And I don't know if conservative is the right word, but it seems like he'd be more of a someone the Syracuse fans can align themselves more with than they were with Gross, which I don't think was always a very fair knock on him, but definitely something like Sean wrote about today. He never quite fit in at home with the Syracuse fans, and a lot of them, I think, felt bad against him. And then now that this came out, I mean, that's why he's kind of gotten – I mean, he's obviously gotten way more heat than they had from internally, and I think that's warranted, but I don't think the fact that he's had a tenuous relationship with the fan base, for better or worse, has really helped him.
All fair. I think for the most part, that can kind of do it for us here, unless you guys had any last-minute tournament thoughts, any other things you wanted to add about Boeheim and Gross before we kind of sign off for the week.
No, just curious what everybody's doing. For me personally, I've been fortunate for the last 4 or 5 years to have absolutely nothing going on during this time of the year, so my slate is pretty much open. My best friends are coming into town for Boys Weekend this weekend. So we are one of my good friends who lives in my town now. He's literally kicking out his wife out of his house, and all of our friends are just shacking up at his house. And we're going to watch a lot of basketball and drink a lot of beer, have a lot of good times. And it's going to be like a 4-day bender, or a three-day bender for me, so I'm excited.
Yeah, it's a little different. The NCAA tournament, kind of a monster, being someone who writes about college sports full-time now. Last year, after the Sunday second round, it's probably the first time I've ever really been burnt out on sports, and I didn't watch anything for the next, 3 days after that, so I'm looking forward to just not wanting anything to do with basketball after Sunday. It's going to be a pretty wild ride in terms of writing about everything and probably watching at least some of every game. I'll probably be very ornery on Monday when it comes to having to – but I'll have a day off, by the way, which will be nice.
I can definitely understand the sports burnout. Not that I do it as much as you do, but I definitely, between writing about it and working on the business end of it, I definitely can reach a saturation point. That'll probably come depending on how the games go. Obviously, if we just start seeing all the top seeds kind of, running through people, if Georgetown somehow manages to beat Eastern Washington, things like that will turn me off in a hurry from things. I know for the most part I had a lot of travel. Recent weeks I have a lot more travel coming up in the next few weekends. Non-college football season is kind of when my wife and I do our traveling and when work has me travel in that regard. So yeah, a lot of things coming up. So I think I'm going to be doing a little lay low weekend, just trying to get through the large amount of beer in my fridge and enjoying basketball and a couch, and that's about it.
Yeah, when Dan talked about burnout, it's actually funny because it kind of reminds me, Dan says, when you're like a sports writer and you're covering sports, when I did it for the newspaper, but most recently when I did for SB Nation, when they used to have their news desk, I worked the noon to midnight shift. Like, I picked up a couple shifts, so it was like a 12-hour, marathon shift. And I understand burnout because it's just like when you're working, when they used to have the news desk, you're just pumping out material like every 15 to 20 minutes, score updates and injury updates or what's, bracket updates and stuff like that. And it can be really taxing for you. So if you're an inspiring sports writer or a person that wants to get into the business, you don't get to enjoy it as much as you used to. That's for sure. That's one of the drawbacks of being part of sports media is you actually have to work while it's going on. But at least it's a good job. It's fun while you're doing it. But yeah, I could remember that day and doing that and being burned out by the weekend.
Yeah, and I'll love Thursday and Friday. Those are still like my favorite 2 days. But after like two full rounds of working probably 11 or 12 hour days, I will definitely be ready for a couple days off. But no, then usually I'll be fine and ready to go. It is weird that Syracuse isn't involved though, because usually I'll be watching all these games with like a little bit, obviously with my bracket in mind, but also like if it's around where Syracuse is seated, kind of just seeing what might lie ahead. So this is definitely going to be a new experience in that regard. Not necessarily a fun one, but probably less pressure filled.
Yeah, that's funny because like I will have to pace myself this year, like in the sense of like there's always, especially when they were getting like the number one seeds and playing at like 9 o'clock at night, where you would have to like you get so excited during the day, but you'd have to make sure like you pace yourself enough to like you're not completely worn out by the end of the day, so you can stay up to the games. It was a lot better when Syracuse was like getting early, early afternoon games, so you could just have a reason to skip work or not pay attention to work. So that was really interesting. That's different. That's the one thing I am missing a lot is just the anxiety of like the day that your team is playing in an NCAA tournament. Because you know you could be like Georgetown fans, you could be out in the first round and it'd be an embarrassment, or it could be like or it could be like a start of like something fantastic, like what we saw in 2013. So that that's the anxiety level there will be missed. But hey, I'm adopting Iowa State, so let's go Fred Hoiberg. Let's get this job done, boys.
I think we've all adopted Iowa State. But after like a month of Pibb and Iowa State, the entirety of the Noon staff is just like, fine, we're rooting for the Cyclones.
I have a unique, and I said this last year too, again, as someone who has to work at the event, not in a writing capacity, but in a business capacity. Last year it was kind of a nightmare for me to have to see UConn and Kentucky this year. Obviously the sooner all the teams that I hate, and that's a long list, are knocked out, the better. I definitely would hate to be, in Indianapolis for the coronation of any number of teams, most notably Georgetown, Villanova, Duke to a point, Notre Dame, but they're going to knock themselves out early. Even Virginia, like, again, the list could go as long as I want it to go, but there are definitely a couple choice teams that I can't stomach having to watch that go down, either in the city or in the stadium.
It's going to be so lovely when Georgetown loses again. It just really is. It's going to be so much fun.
I may never change my Twitter avatar if Georgetown loses to a double digit team.
I already have tweets drafted. We are all Eagles is going to be one. The Georgetown fisting gif is going to be another one.
I'll say, I don't know. I don't want to commit to like keeping my avatar as the EWE logo for like, I don't know. I'll probably keep it like that at least to the end of maybe the end of April. I was not saying until next basketball season, but that's a long time.
Yeah.
And that's a late game tomorrow too. It's like 10:15 start tomorrow night. So.
And it's important, right? That's gonna be all Eagles.
Yeah, it's a home game.
I love everything about it. It's setting up perfectly.
No, I'm a fan, and the fact that I will once again be at the gym while it's on, just like I was during the Florida Gulf Coast game, gives me some very good vibes.
Yeah, it always makes you run a little bit harder.
Honestly, NCAA tournament, I got some of my best runs in every single year because I'll watch. It's, for me, it sucks because I spend the entire day not being productive because games start at 9 a.m. And then I pretty much just go the whole day not paying attention to work, paying attention to that. And then I head to the gym and then watch maybe, two or three games, hopefully some nail biters, while getting to around, it depends. But I can usually get to the 3 or 4 mile mark without much hesitation because I'm just, so fixed on a game.
Oh, yeah, I agree 100%. Like, usually during, like, getting back to the gym and running, I purposely, especially on the weekends, make sure, like, I watch the first half of, like, the noon game, and then, like, travel to the gym, and then I can watch the whole second half of a game. And then, obviously, if it's close, I mean, you're not even paying attention to running. You're just watching the game. And like you said, you can get some really good workouts in. I won't be doing that this year, though. I'll be drinking.
also a good fat activity, so.
That's right.
And on that note, I think we're good. Guys, thanks, as always, for joining us here on Troy Noons and Absolute Podcast.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, no problem.
Hopefully next week when we talk about Georgetown's departure of the tournament, we can have a little player hater the ball type fun.
Yeah, no.
Oh, man.
Happy first round of the NCAA tournament, fellas. Enjoy. It's always fun.
Yeah, see you guys in the
next time. You guys enjoy too. And to everybody listening at home, please be sure to rate, review, subscribe, the whole deal on Blog Talk, on iTunes. We like you, so hopefully you like us. And, go Eastern Washington Eagles.
Go Eagles.
Eastern Washington.